WA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind of it?
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merger 295. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there. Same airplanes.
And it is
such.
Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty. Four calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello and welcome to the show, everyone, wherever in the world you are listening from. I hope you all had a great week. We are joined tonight by Dr. Bruce Solheim. Bruce is currently a distinguished professor of history at Citrus College, Glendora, California, and will be a featured speaker at this year's Contact in the Desert 2021, a wonderful event with a great lineup this year. He has also authored several books covering his own extraterrestrial and paranormal personal history, of which he will be sharing for us tonight. But first, if you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find the link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Hello. How are you, Nick?
I'm good, thank you. It's great having you on today. And you're calling from California.
Yeah, Southern California, LA County, Los Angeles County.
How's the weather? Because we've just got torrential rain here in the UK.
That would be nice. We could use some of that. We did get a little sprinkle here and there the last couple of days. It's cooler. It's like in the 70s, which is unusual for this time of year, usually when we're in the 80s or higher. So we're getting, we're kind of enjoying this, the 70s, and but it'll get hot soon enough.
I was talking to a guy earlier, and he's in Texas, and his air conditioning is all broken.
Oh, no. Yeah, this is, I grew up in Seattle, so I never had air conditioning. As a kid, we just opened the window, never got that hot, And so living in Southern California, and when I lived in the South, too, in North Carolina and Alabama, then I learned that you have to have air conditioning. Or even when I lived in Ohio in the summertime, oh my gosh, yeah, you got to have AC.
You need the AC. Good stuff. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce, you've had a lifetime of experiences going back to the 1960s. Would you like to start at the very beginning for us, please, sir?
Yeah, I grew up in Seattle. My parents were immigrants from Norway. I actually had my first experience in Norway, my first paranormal experience. It was an angelic healing experience on an island 200 miles above the Arctic Circle in northern Norway, and very isolated island. Only way on was by a little ferry boat or by, they had an airport, so you can get there by airplane as well. But we were living with my grandmother for about 9 months. We lived with her and in this old farmhouse, and I got really sick. I mean, really, really sick. I was 4 years old. Or maybe five. I got really, really sick, and I couldn't move my head from side to side. My neck was stiff. My arms and legs were getting stiff, and I had a really high fever, and they thought, they didn't know what was happening. They put me in this little bed in the kitchen that my grandmother had to take naps in when she was cooking or whatever, and because the steps were too steep for her sometimes. And I would lay down there, and everybody came over, the relatives next door came over, and they said, oh my gosh, he might have, this is what happened when Uncle Sven got polio. And you know, that it was just scaring me to death. And I remember crying. I cried myself to sleep. And I woke up and nobody was in the kitchen. And there was this bright light in, you know, there were no lights on in the kitchen, but there was this bright, warm light above me in the ceiling, by these old beams in the ceiling. And I looked at it and I realized that I was going to be okay. I felt this healing warmth and this, just this pleasantness came over me, like I had nothing to worry about. And then I went to sleep. And then when I got up, my mom and my grandmother were there, and I told them about this light. And I jumped out of the bed and I was moving around and everything was fine. I didn't have a fever anymore. And my mom and my grandmother said it was a miracle. And I told them about the light, and they said, well, it sounds like an angel. Sounds like it was your guardian angel that saved you. So from that point on, Nick, that's when I think it opened the doors for the rest of my life, up to including today when I took a spirit walk. I've had a paranormal life ever since. That was the first experience that I remember. And that was in 1962. And I had my first extraterrestrial experience in 1964. It ended up being a positive experience, in that what happened was that there was this family that lived above us where we lived in Seattle, on the hill, the steep hill. And occasionally I would go to their house when my parents went places, so they could babysit me. Well, the man that lived there was a very bizarre person, and he would do weird things. And there was always kids over at the house because they had three kids. So, and he would act like a little child, which I thought was, even though I was only 6 years old, I knew something was up with that. Something was wrong. And he would give us little Dixie cups filled with what he said was juice or Kool-Aid, but it smelled funny, so I didn't drink it. And now I know what it was. It was alcohol. And he would hide in a closet and make the kids come into the dark closet with him and be in the dark closet, where he would do, you know, various things, I guess. I never went in the closet, so I didn't do it. I was too afraid. Well, I knew something was wrong. And then when I was looking through my window into the backyard towards that house, I saw a very tall being, a non-human being, and an extraterrestrial. He had a upside-down teardrop-shaped head with large eyes, and he was able to speak to me telepathically, and he told me that that was a very bad person, and I shouldn't go up there anymore, and he'll make sure that I don't go up there anymore. I told him, I said, well, you look kind of scary. How do I know I can trust you? And he said, well, you know, you can't always judge people by how they look. He's the really bad one. So it was kind of a rescue in a way, because I told my parents I didn't want to go up to that house anymore. And they said, that's fine. You don't have to. And the other things I remember is that he had shown me a ship, but he showed it to me like in a hologram, you know, what it looked like. And I said that I wanted to fly someday. And he said, well, you probably will. And sure enough, you know, later I became a pilot in the, not an astronaut like I wanted to be, but, you know, a helicopter pilot, which is pretty cool, in the Army. But that was, my first experience. And some of these are memories that I have that are actual conscious memories, and others I've gone through, hypnosis with Yvonne Smith to kind of fill out the details of it. But that was my first experience. And I continued to have paranormal experiences, you know, hearing dead people in coffins speaking to me, and practicing mind reading with my mother, and you name it. And then in 1973, I had another very profound UFO experience or alien experience, in that it was Christmas Eve, and my aunt was visiting with my uncle, and as my aunt was my dad's youngest sister. Anyway, they were visiting from Norway, And in the middle of the night after Christmas Eve, my cat, who always slept with me, jumped off the bed suddenly and woke me up. And then I looked up and I saw my aunt in the doorway. Now, I thought it was very weird. Why is my aunt in the doorway? And there was these little people around her, but they didn't look like people. They looked, you know, like some kind of entities. Now I know that they were ETs, but and all of a sudden my aunt's face morphed into this thing that looked like a kind of a reptile, you know. And the next thing I know, I'm paralyzed and I'm taken up through the ceiling, through the roof, into the heavens, you know, into the stars. And I end up on a table, and there's these little gray aliens around me. And there's a doctor who is an insectoid who looks kind of like a praying mantis, a cross between a praying mantis and a Jerusalem cricket, if you've ever seen one of those. And they were doing some kind of procedure. I don't know exactly what it was. They had an implement that was kind of being moved around telekinetically, psychokinetically. That kind of looked like a lawn dart, and it was somewhere near my abdomen, but I don't know what was going on. And I asked this insectoid, you know, what's going on? And he said, this is special processing. That's all you need to know. And then he admonished some of the little guys, these little grays, who, because they had put some kind of a restraining thing on my head that hurt. And I told the bug doctor that it hurt. And he made them remove it. So that's the experience I had in 73. In between all these things, of course, there's all these paranormal things happening, seeing ghosts and so forth. And in 77, I took a road trip. I'm 18 years old. Me and my friend, I call him Ernie. Anyway, Ernie and I took this trip from Seattle to Salt Lake City to Las Vegas, and then the Grand Canyon, and then to LA, and then back up the coast to Seattle. Well, the first night of the trip, we were on our way to Salt Lake City. We got to Idaho, to this wilderness area called Black Pine Peak. And it was completely dark when we got there. We thought we would see a campground, but we couldn't find it. So we just pulled off on the side of this dirt road by a clearing kind of up in the towards the mountain, towards the peak. And we didn't even have time to put up a tent. We were too tired. So we're just sleeping in the car with our sleeping bags over us. And all of a sudden we started seeing these lights all around us. You know, they were like, we thought they were like other cars or something, but the lights were not positioned right. They were too high. They were like shining from up above, you know, so it didn't make any sense. But we also felt paralyzed. Like we couldn't move, couldn't do anything about it. And then I felt like there was people around the vehicle. I couldn't identify them. They were kind of like dark shadows. And, those are the conscious memories that I have. And then I did a hypnotic session with Yvonne, and one of the first things she asked me was, look next to you, the seat next to you, where Ernie is and what's going on. So as she's taking me through the hypnosis, I'm going deeper into my memory, and I see the subconscious memory, and I look, and Ernie's gone. He's gone. He's not there, which shocked me, you know? So, and then I told her, I explained what the dark figures looked like. They were obviously not humans. Some of them were tall, some were short, but they were, I guess you'd classify them as the grays. I was not taken though, but Ernie was. So I decided to contact Ernie because I'd never spoken to him about this because we never talked about it on the trip. I knew something weird had happened, but we didn't really talk about it, strangely enough. So I called him. This was, I don't know, about three years ago or so. And I said, Ernie, do you remember that trip? And he said, oh yeah, that was so weird. Yeah. Black Pine Peak. Yeah. There was like these lights and I felt, you know, paralyzed and we thought there were people outside of the car. And I said, exactly. And I said, well, I'm writing a book of the story about that. And he goes, oh really? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh yeah, that's cool. And then I said, well, you know, I have a theory about it. And he said, what's that? And I said, I think you were abducted. And all of a sudden his mood changed and he goes, you're not allowed to mention my name. So that obviously I changed his name to Ernie. And you're not allowed to mention my name. And maybe I'll write my own book, you know, before yours comes out. And he refused to talk anymore to me. So I kept sending him emails and calling him. He didn't respond. Finally, he did respond. And he emailed me and he said, you know what? And then I told him I felt bad, you know, because he said, when he was mad at me when I told him what I was doing. He said, "I felt like you tricked me. You know, why didn't you say that right away that you thought it was a UFO experience?" And I said, "Because I'm just putting all this together. I don't, you know, we're learning what had happened." And he got really mad. And I said, "Well, I feel really bad, you know, about that. You think I did this, you know, to deceive you. I didn't. I was just trying to learn what you knew." And finally, he did email me back and he said, "The reason you feel bad is because you allowed your best friend to be abducted." And he said, "I do remember something. And I remember that I was surrounded by aliens and they said, this one looks like a squealer. You'd think he'd never seen pincers before." You know, pincers, horrible imagery, right? Pincers. He said, "I felt drugged." And so that's probably why you feel bad. And then I have not heard from him since. That was the last communication I had with him. Well, at that point, I remembered that I had written some poetry after that trip, that road trip, about weird things that happened to us. And one of the things I wrote about was that experience. And I don't really remember the poem that much, but when I looked into my files, and I still have it, the name of the poem was Visitors. It was in two parts. Visitors was part one, and then part two was I Sold Out to the Aliens. And it was this weird thing about how mean they are and how I allowed things to happen. I don't mention Ernie's name, but I at the end of the poem, I talk about pincers, you know, and that there's nothing you can do. There's nothing I can do. I mentioned pincers. Well, when I read that, I didn't remember writing that in the poem, but there it was from 1977. So now I had this this piece of this historical document in the form of a poem. And I have Ernie's recollections, and I have my conscious recollections, and I have the the hypnotic regression, retrieved subconscious memories. So I asked Yvonne about it, and she said it's very normal when two people have an abduction experience to have that one of them will refuse to really talk about it or acknowledge it. And it usually breaks up friendships. It breaks up marriages, relationships. She said that's very common to have that happen. So, yeah, that was the experience in 1977. Kind of brings all that together. I forgot to mention in 1964, as a result of that first contact, I was a normal kid. But after that contact, for 2 years, I had trouble speaking. So I actually had such a terrible stuttering and stammering problem that I could barely communicate. And of course, when I did, I was teased. So that just makes you go further inward, right? You don't want to talk. So I didn't talk. So they put me in special speech therapy every day for about 2 years before I finally started to talk again. Did some research on it. This kind of malady can occur for children who've had a traumatic experience, that they can actually develop a speech impediment or stammering or stuttering problem. I forgot what it's called, the medical term, but there is such a thing. So I had a physical reaction to it, even though I look at it as a positive experience, because actually I was rescued from a child molester. But still, that doesn't mean it wasn't traumatic to see an alien when you're 6 years old, you know, because you don't really understand what's going on. And then the last before the Anzar experience of what my latest book is about. In 1978, I had another rescue experience, and I was living in my brother's garage. I had lost my job. I had lost my girlfriend, and I had no money, and I was living in my brother's garage, totally depressed. I was ready to kill myself. I had a knife to my throat. I was ready. And at that point, at the lowest point of my life, a particle beam emerged, and it kind of came from the ceiling of the garage into the floor of the concrete floor of the garage, the cement floor, right at the base of this old dirty mattress I was sleeping on. And I was taken up in this beam through the garage roof into the heavens so I could see the stars. I don't remember going into a ship, but these are my conscious memories, right? And when I returned, next thing I know, I'm back. I don't know how long it took, 5 minutes, an hour, I don't know. But I was back on the mattress and the beam was gone, and I had no inclination at all to want to kill myself. So I feel like it was a rescue, that there was a reason why I wasn't allowed. It was an intervention, if you will. So unlike a lot of folks, like my friend Terry Lovelace, who had a very traumatic, bad experience, my experiences, although they've been traumatic, have ultimately been something positive for me in my life. Since that time, you know, I kept having all these paranormal experiences, including, you know, full-bodied apparitions, visions of people who've passed on. You know, I if there was something paranormal going on in an area, I usually picked up on it. I'd have trouble going to parties because I could not hear people's thoughts, but I could sense their intentions, which is just as bad. So I would tend to shut down and not want to go to, you know, gatherings. And so I had this thing going on. I didn't quite understand it. I didn't know how to manage it. And in 2016, when a dear friend of mine, by this time I had an academic career, a professor of history, my friend Gene died, and he's also Norwegian American. We grew up together. I was devastated by it. And a month after he passed away of cancer, I saw him. He came to me and spoke to me, and he told me that he was there to tell me that it's time to tell my stories, that don't wait any longer. Time to tell my stories, all my paranormal stories, which I then proceeded to do. I wrote 3 books about 89 different paranormal experiences, including my alien experiences. I call them reunions rather than abductions because I think we're all related. But anyway, so he convinced me to do that. And I all my fears were unfounded. I didn't lose my job. My colleagues love me. My students love me. They enjoy my stories. Nobody has been negative about it. I'm still working. So the books have been well received. And so I decided to go a little bit further, and I asked the college if I could teach a paranormal course, thinking that, oh, they'll never agree to it. They agreed to it. So before the pandemic, I had been teaching a paranormal course, and I'll continue after we go back, probably in the fall. And this whole time, I was doing this spirit communication. My daily, not daily, probably every 2 or 3 days, I'll take a spirit walk where I meditate and I reach out to my parents and to those that have passed on, to Gene, my friend, and others. And on request, sometimes if people have a relative that passed away, I will make contact with them, or at least I'll try. So I have these mediumship abilities. And I started making contact with this this alien. And it turned out it was this alien I had a vision of in 1997, called himself the Progenitor. And he gave me all this information about how, the quantum world works. And it was kind of over my head at the time, but I wrote it all down. And I even drew a picture of what he looked like, kind of like a proto-human. That's what he looked like. Very tall. And so I asked during one of these spirit walks, I asked Gene and my other spirit friends that I'd been talking to, I said, could I talk to the Progenitor? And they said, yeah, he's ready to, he thinks you're ready and he's ready to talk to you. And so I started communicating with him, and I've been communicating with him the past 3 years. I since then found out his name is Anzar, A-N-Z-A-R. I've since found out that he was the person, the alien who rescued me in 1964. That was him. And he has proceeded to give me warnings about what's coming up. He calls them, he doesn't like to call them predictions. He says these are needed preparations, because he said predictions can be wrong, but preparations are never wrong. So like a year before the pandemic, he said there was going to be a series of calamities to prepare for them. In this book that I just wrote, Anzar, the Progenitor, I go over all the communication. I took probably 300 pages of single space notes based on my communication with him. And I culled that down into half of the book is my communication with Anzar, and half of it is my my take on what I think, how all this works, you know, what I call the my quantum reality, you know, that the spirit world, the alien world, and the quantum world are all the same. So the book is very academic, as opposed to my timeless books, which are more anecdotes, you know, different stories of my paranormal experiences, no footnotes or anything. This book is heavily footnoted, so it's like 400 pages. So it's a very academic book, but yet it also has this wisdom from this ancient alien. And so it's far out, you know, it's way out there, but yet it's grounded in this theoretical analysis, the first half of the book. So he's told me, he's warned me about what would be happening in America before it started happening, before we started having riots. He said that Memorial Day would be a problem. And that's when George Floyd was last year. That's when he was in May. That's when he died in police custody. And he warned me about, rioting. He warned me about as early as October or September or October of 2020. Yeah, September and October of 2020. He told me that there would be a rebellion, a pocket revolution, and an insurrection. Now, he used the word insurrection. So, and then, of course, on January 6th, 2021, some kind of fanatical followers of the president, of our previous president, decided to invade the Capitol building. And we now call it an insurrection. So he has given me these prophetic statements, you know, even though he doesn't like to say that it's predictions, because he said there's too many variables that can, you know, happen. He has warned me to prepare, which I've been prepared at every time. We were very prepared for the pandemic, my wife and I. And so we weathered through it pretty well. And I just share this in this book. I share everything that he's taught me, everything that he's said. One of the things he says every single time, and you think it sounds kind of like cliche in a way, but it's really not. He said, always keep love in your heart and approach everything from a position of love. And I've heard other experiencers and people who have had near-death experiences, and that they kind of have the same message. And it's like I said, it sounds kind of corny in a way, but if you really practice it, it sounds so easy. But I've tried to apply it to every situation, and it really, things come out a lot better, you know, when you have that attitude in life. And but he's shared other, you know, more technical things with me, like he said, all of this is an illusion, you know, which fits into this holographic or, you know, what do they call it? A simulation theory of reality, you know, that kind of stuff. So he's gotten some pretty heavy things. And it's all in the book. And so there's a little bit of something for everybody in my latest book, which is called Anzar the Progenitor. But that was kind of in a nutshell what's been going on with me. No pun intended.
Join me, George Norrie, for the Worldwide Contact in the Desert Virtual UFO Conference, June 25th to June 28th. Contact in the Desert is an epic weekend of adventure jam-packed with exciting explorations into UFOs, ancient civilizations, AI, crop circles, forbidden archaeology, disclosure, and the newest evidence of ongoing contact, sightings, and leading-edge science. This amazing weekend delivers more than 130 presentations and special events showcasing 67 speakers from all over the world, with 2 extra weeks to view your favorite leading experts, including Avi Loeb with Clyde Lewis, Linda Moulton Howe, Paul Hellyer, John Lear, Russell Targ, David Childress, Doc Wallach, and more. With breaking articles in the New York Times and acknowledged naval sightings, and more importantly, the new release of classified documents on the day of the soft opening of Contact in the Desert, we are your source for inside information. Join us June 25th at contactinthedesert.com to get your tickets today. Make contact, contactinthedesert.com.
For our listeners' benefit, have you got a website, Bruce?
Yes, my website where people can check in on what I'm doing is www.bruceolavsolheim.com. And my first name, Bruce, middle name is spelled O-L-A-V. As in Victor, and then Solheim, S-O-L-H-E-I-M, as in Michael, BruceOlavSolheim.com. And there are all my books, my plays, my music, my everything I've done is basically on that. I've just, you know, piled it into that website. And my books are all available on Amazon. I publish comic books as well. I'm really into comic books. I just published one. In fact, the Snark series, Snark 2, just came out in March, And it keeps me very busy. I used to do the art too, but I'm not up to snuff for the standards. My standards are too high for my own art. So I have a guy that does the art for Snark, and he's been working illustrating comics since the 1970s, a guy named Gary Dumm, D-U-M-M. And he did Snark 1 and Snark 2. And Snark is basically a story of an alien hybrid who comes to Earth to prepare us for colonization. Now, hopefully this is not a prediction, but we'll see, right? So he comes to Earth, and he has a sidekick, kind of a wisecracking sidekick called the Cosmic Staff. And we find out what his origin is in Snark 2. But anyway, he comes to Earth, and he has all these adventures, meeting everyday Americans. You know, he meets homeless people, people crossing the border, Native Americans, working class people on vacation, whatever, and finds them to be very interesting and fascinating, even if I can use that term. So he's learning. He's kind of an innocent abroad kind of a thing. But he's got this terrible mission. He's got to prepare humans for colonization by his home planet of reptilians, by the way, because he's half reptilian. But he changes his mind. He said, no, I can't do it. These are nice people. I don't want them to be enslaved. So I'm going to turn against my hosts, as he calls them, back at the home planet. And I'm going to help the humans. I'm going to help them repel this this invasion. So that kind of sets up the tension for the whole thing. And later in Snark 2, you find out who the Cosmic Staff is. And there's a lot of comedy. There's history there, because I'm a historian, so you got to throw in the history. Science fiction, fantasy, humor. There's a lot of humor. The Cosmic Staff fancies himself to be kind of a 60s Rat Pack, cool cat kind of guy. You know, that's his period of history that he really enjoys, the 60s. So he's, you know, he talks like that, whereas Snark is more of the straight man, you know. So it's a fun comic. And so I do that too. I do a little bit of everything. I write plays, and yeah, I just love writing and creating. But anyway, at that website, you can kind of catch all that stuff.
It's good to have passion, isn't it?
Yeah, I just go wherever I'm compelled to go. It's just it's not like I sit down and plan out my whole life. Okay, I'm going to do this and then that. It's just like, oops, it comes up. Like my latest thing, there's a spinoff comic from Snark. It's going to be a prequel, and it features one of the characters that emerges in Snark 2, and it's a female character. I wanted to do a female based comic with female sensibilities, because I thought young girls deserve to have comic heroes too, you know. And so her name is Dr. Jekyll, and she's an alien hunter. So Dr. Jekyll, alien hunter, she's an anthropologist following in her father's footsteps, who was someone who researched ancient aliens. She's going to have her own comic, and I found a wonderful young artist from Poland. I think she's only 20 years old, and she's incredibly talented. I mean, I have an eye for comic art, and this girl is going places, and I enlisted her to help me publish that. So my friend Gary's going to get a year off while we publish Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter. And then the year after that, we'll do Snark 3. So that's about as far as I've planned. And I don't know about any more paranormal books, but if I need to, I will. And you know, who knows, I might write another play or two. So we'll see what happens. I do what I'm compelled to do.
And you're a college professor as well, aren't you? And it's good how well, you know, this was received by your peers and the students.
Yeah, I have my students. Yeah, I have my students do, if they want extra, you know, they always ask about extra credit. And I said, okay, fine, read my comic books. All right, fine, read my paranormal books. And they love it, especially the comic books. And I think it connects to them. You know, I'm kind of tricking them into learning about history, because these different adventures Snark has have to do with historical places in the U.S., you know, right now. But I'm going to branch out to other countries too. I want it to be international. In fact, there's a lot of interest in Japan right now for Snark. So he'll probably have to go to Japan. It's not like everything happens in the US, you know. He should probably go to England too, I would think.
Almost definitely.
That would be good. I wouldn't have to have it translated into Japanese, which is what I would have to do for the Japanese market, which is fine. Yeah, it's just so much fun. You know, there doesn't seem to be any end point. You know, people ask about, you know, when are you going to retire? And I don't see myself retiring. You know, I mean, I don't want to be like a a fossil, you know, trying to teach my classes. And I guess at a certain point, they'll have to usher me out the door, but that could be a while yet.
Tell me about this paranormal course as well.
Yeah, I call it a paranormal personal history, because my take on history is that all history is personal. And what I mean by that is that history begins and ends with the individual. And I give an example to my students. I say, now, when America goes to war, America doesn't really go to war. Individual Americans go to war. They have experiences. Those experiences then are woven together into this fabric that we call our national history. It's each and every person that makes a contribution. And I try to empower my students that way. So that's kind of how I approach the paranormal too, is that's why I called it paranormal personal history. And man, when I first offered that course in 2018, I got the first class, I had 35 students. It was an in-person class, ranging in age from 20s to, I think I had an 80-year-old woman in the class, and, they were all had one purpose, and that was to be, have a place to safely share their stories. And I, because of my wife, Ginger, who was also in the classroom, she said, you know, because I had it planned out. Oh, I was going to lecture about the history of the paranormal and spiritualism in America and the Fox sisters in the 1820s or whatever. And she said, just give them a chance to tell their stories. They're going to love it. So I listened to my wife, Ginger, which is always a good move on my part when I do that. And I said, okay, we're going to spend half the class time sharing, you know, within reason. Some people go too long, so you got to kind of harness them a little bit. But man, the students loved it. And I offered the course every semester until the pandemic struck. And I'd get the same people taking the course, plus new people. You know, they want to take it over and over again because some of them couldn't talk to their own relatives. They couldn't talk to their own spouses or friends or coworkers. But in this class, they could talk about their experiences. And it was my job to offer that safe place to talk about it and provide some kind of structure so they can understand how these things might work, the theoretical part of it, the paranormal. And then also bring in guest speakers, which I did. Everybody from scientists, like the leading paranormal scientist, Dr. Dean Radin at the IONS Institute, the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California. That was the one founded by Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut. I brought him in. I brought in magicians to talk about the difference between real magic and stage magic. You know, there's kind of a crossover where a lot of people suspected it, but he confirmed it, and it does happen. I brought in a member of the clergy, talk about the paranormal nature of God. And he said something really funny. He said, if God isn't paranormal, then who is? I always thought that was funny. So that was a preacher. I brought in a number of different people, you know, psychics, and we did a seance. I brought in a paranormal investigative team, and we looked at different parts of the campus that are haunted, and we found some things. So we did experiments. It was a lot of fun. I look forward to hopefully next fall starting that up again.
That sounds really interesting. And obviously it's all in person. Have you ever maybe think up set up some cameras and have it as kind of like more people can participate via Zoom or something?
I thought about it. I had an online version ready to go, but I couldn't get enough interest. And I think a lot of it has to do with privacy. People are, you know, like the CIRO group that I belong to, the Close Encounter Resource Organization, president is Yvonne Smith. It's the same thing. You know, a lot of the members feel good in person, but if you put a camera on them, they're not going to say anything. And if you have this kind of class and people don't feel comfortable about talking about their experiences, there goes half of the reason, at least half of the reason they're there, if not the main reason. So it just hasn't fit so far into that modality, although you could get it closed, you know, where only by invitation, only by, you know, whatever. So, but it's very much every class is a little different. You kind of get the feeling of the room and what people are going through. And that's really hard to do in a electronic medium or in a Zoom, you know, or whatever. So I'm not adverse to doing it, you know, if there's enough demand, but right now it feels right to do it in person. And I think the students really appreciate that.
It's definitely a good idea. Obviously, you know, I think that's a great idea anyway, because it's pretty much what this show is. But yeah, but that sounds really cool, actually. More universities really should be doing that.
Yeah, very few. I think Dean Radin, that researcher I told you about, said there's probably only 6 universities, colleges and universities that offer a paranormal class in the United States. Only 6. in a country of 330 million people, and who knows how many thousands of colleges and universities we have. I think that's pathetic. I think there's so much interest, as you know. I don't know about England, but I know there's a lot of interest in England, in the UK. So I would think that, you know, maybe I could just, if people are interested, if professors are interested in venturing into this, if they want to, you know, get a hold of me through my website, I'll tell them everything I know if they want to start their own course. You know, it's not like I have to be the one in charge. You know? So just give them some tips on what I've learned.
Probably something needs to be, you know, taught, because everyone has experiences, or at least everyone knows someone that's had an experience.
Yeah. And I even had skeptics take the class. And by the end of the class, it's not like I'm indoctrinating them. They just learn that, oh my gosh, I guess that I've had paranormal experiences that they didn't know about. And so it's not that they become true believers after the class, but they become kind of agnostic, and they have a, you know, I could be true. You know,
open them up a little bit more to it.
Yes. And that's the whole thing. You just want to expose people to it and see where they want to go with their adventure, because I can't dictate to other people what they should do or think or whatever. I just go over what's happened to me. I have a theoretical framework for the class, and people talk about their experiences, and we bring in wonderful guest speakers, and the magic happens.
I've had quite a few emails from people which had no interest in the subject whatsoever. And they kind of just stumbled upon my show by mistake. And they said, you know, I didn't really have an interest in this. And I started listening, and now I can't get enough. I just want to learn and listen to everything. So, yeah, so it's good. It is good.
I think so. I think it's only going to increase, as we talked about earlier, the dramatic events that are going on, even though I think people shouldn't get their hopes up too high. I think we kind of both agreed about that with UFOs, but the ball is being moved down the field. You know, I think it's moving down the field. Now, it's probably not near the net, to put it in soccer terms, but it is being moved down the field a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard people talking about it, which they wouldn't usually speak about these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a good, at least it's a start, you know, no matter what the actual outcome is going to be.
Yeah. And I've stuck my neck out. I had a former student who's now a professor, history professor at a prestigious university in the United States. And they, I sent them a copy of my first paranormal book, and they told me, you've just committed academic suicide. You know, that's the prevailing thought that a lot of professional scientists, engineers, and academicians have about this. And that's unfortunate, because we need their help. And in my case, you know, I'm 62 years old. So what are they going to do to me? Even if they turned on me, you know, what are they going to do? I'm close to, you know, a retirement age. I don't want to retire, but so it's not like I I'm not going to try to get a job at another university or anything. So I really don't have anything to lose and everything to gain. And it's really been more of a positive experience. So I'd say if there were teachers out there, professors who are interested, you know, they can use my exam. Not to say that it would go well for everybody, because I assume there might be situations where it wouldn't. And I know that there's, you know, in the past, like people like John Mack, the late John Mack, the psychiatrist at Harvard, who started treating people who've had abductions, and what they tried to drive him out of the university, you know, his colleagues did. That's so right. They turned on him and the administration. So that can happen. I'm lucky it did not happen to me.
I know I do have quite a few teachers out there listening. So it's always definitely something, you know, should be looked at.
Yeah. And I, if anybody wants to talk to me about my experiences or specifically how they might adapt it into what they're doing, I'm more than happy to talk to them. Email me. My email is on the website.
For our listeners, all the links to Bruce are in the show notes below or on the website. So it's very easy to have a direct link to Bruce. And you're also going to be at this year's Contact in the Desert. You're actually a speaker there.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, Nick, I'll be, it runs from the 25th of June to the 28th, I believe. And, I have a lecture on the 25th. I have a panel on the 27th, I think. An abduction panel that I'm part of with other speakers. So it's a wonderful conference. I was invited to speak last year in person, and of course I got canceled. So this year we're doing it virtually. But with all the interest going on, I think we're going to get a good size of people that, you know, want to watch. And I'll be doing question and answer after my my lecture. And so I think it'll be our lecture story. I don't want to say it's really a lecture. It's not boring. It's pretty fun, actually. Actually, my history lectures aren't really lectures either. They're more of a discussion. They're very personal. And that's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it. They're a wonderful group of people, the people that run the Contact in the Desert, and so many interesting speakers. You know, some people are famous, some people are not so famous, but are, you know, just as interesting nonetheless.
All links to Contact in the Desert 2021 are below in the show notes. Wonderful. I really appreciate you coming on today, Bruce. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Well, I appreciate the invite, and I had a great time talking to you. I really love what you're doing. You know, keep doing what you're doing. It's a nice approach, and I'm hoping that everything continues to get better and better.
Yeah, great stuff. And you enjoy the rest of your evening.
All right, bye.
That is all for this episode. Keep yourself connected and updated with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you've had an encounter you would like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com or reach out to me via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to Bruce for sharing tonight, and thank you for listening. I will return next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.